Hello, this is a new podcast from TV Cream. It's called What We Just Watched. My name is Graham.
And I'm Ian.
In every episode, we're going to convene to talk about two television shows we've just watched. One of the shows has been selected by me.
And one by me. But the slight novelty is neither of us know which programme the other has chosen.
So, whose are we going to look at first? Let's toss the Tomorrow's World commemorative coin to decide. Ian, you can call it.
I'm going to go for Judith Hand.
Okay. It's Peter McCann. Oh. That means we're going to start with my choice.
Okay, I'm going to hit play.
Okay, go on. Well, it's a good choice. Very good choice.
Okay, so we're going to settle back and watch it, and then we will catch up with Ian's thoughts and responses after this. So what we just watched was the very first episode of Master Team, which aired on the 21st of October 1985. What sort of a slot, Ian?
Tea time slot.
Welcome to our new knockout quiz programme, Master Team. Now, we're going to be with you every weeknight. That's Monday through Friday for the next 9 weeks, along with teams from all over Britain who are competing for the title of Master Team 1985.
So watching that with you, my impression was initial delight, and then it moved into a kind of, as it continued, would disinterest be too strong?
Restlessness, I think, is a better word, because I had forgotten that the show is very repetitive. It doesn't build towards any conclusion. There isn't a crescendoing of tension at all. If anything, the reverse happens. It all disperses, really, I thought. And the problem there is to do with the fact that the rounds within the quiz repeat themselves. They just go around in a circle.
The thing I think that has surprised you was that it's not a discrete game within the running time. It's 25 minutes of an ongoing series of games.
Yeah, so it's just like we've dipped into a very long running marathon bout of quizzing, and we've just seen a tiny sliver of it. And we're expected to sort of to run with it and to stick with it.
So when Master Team begins, there's a phrase that Angela uses.
Now, it's a nice, easy game, this.
Did you find that reassuring?
Yeah, I noted that down. Well, I noted down the fact that she said it's a nice, easy game. She also said that it was her intention to encourage the teams on their way. Yes, well, I think with any new quiz show, especially the first episode of a quiz show, those sorts of sentiments are very important. Because, yeah, I mean, at that time of day, just before tea, or you've come in from work, or you're still in from school, the last thing you want to see, I think, at that time of the day is something which is going to be too demanding. And that sort of light quizzing.
So a nice, easy game is what you want. She does, though. My feeling watching that is she frets about the rules.
She spends far too long talking about what's going to happen instead of it actually happening.
And she does say twice within the opening episode, you know the rules by now. But then as she's just explained them again. I want to talk a bit about the setting, and I wondered, do you think we're supposed to be inside a pyramid of knowledge?
Well, I was struck by how dark the studio is, how gloomy it looked. The audience are in almost darkness, and probably that's something to do with the fact that they're not many people are there, and they're trying to maybe make it look slightly mysterious. Angela kind of sits in front of one tier of audience, but you never see the rest of the studio, but maybe that's all there are. Maybe there's only about 40 or 50 people there.
And we both,
it's quite a small pyramid then.
A detail I think we both enjoyed was that her mounted stick mic remains in shot.
Oh, well, this is the whole thing has been designed from a mid-80s book, a mid-80s style guide, because she's got very lots of unnecessary furniture around her, and lots of angular furniture. The desk has got lots of sharp corners, and this microphone is very ostentatious, isn't it? There's no attempt to make it discreet. When you notice it, you can't stop noticing it. That's the problem, I think. Every time you cut back to her, that's the first thing you see. This is the first step forward from Terry Wogan's stick mic, from Blankety Blank.
It's a mounted stick mic.
They've discovered how to attach it to something, to a bit of furniture. And now they want to make sure that the whole country knows it.
There are a couple of catchphrases that she is very clearly laying in. Well, did you catch them, what they are?
Well, let's play.
Let's play.
Which I can see why she keeps mentioning that, because every good quiz show has to have at least one catchphrase. But I can imagine that after watching it night after night, that would become a bit annoying.
What's the other one?
Don't know.
It's still yours.
That's not a catchphrase. Well, she that's a description of that. That's just a bit of exposition.
But she says that when someone gets the end of a round and it beeps, but they haven't had a chance to.
Well,
answer.
I didn't pick up on that as a catchphrase.
So
she needed to work on that a bit more.
You acknowledge it is a catchphrase?
No, I don't think
you,
it is.
You don't
well,
think
if
it, is?
If it was intended to be one, it didn't succeed because I didn't register it as a catchphrase. And I don't think she delivered it with the authority it needed as a catchphrase.
Something else which I think is worth discussing are the noises in the show. Now,
do you mean the musical noises or the sound effects?
We'll talk about the sound effects first, and then I'd like to talk about the musical stings. I think that they're quite jarring, particularly the spotlight round selection noise.
We nominate Janet.
Janet, yeah.
I think that they are not sounds. They're musical stings.
Oh, so you think all the things are musical stings?
Yeah.
Okay. The music is actually composed by a gentleman called Graham Prescott.
Well, he didn't get a credit, I noticed, at the end.
And he uses a Yamaha DX5.
How did you find this out?
I can't remember.
Are you just making that up?
No, it's true.
Because that's what everyone used in the mid-80s.
So where else would you hear a Yamaha DX5?
You'd hear it on, I'm sure Richard Stilgo had one, on Finders Keepers.
So Richard Stilgo's InVision Yamaha DX5.
Yes.
On Finders
right,
Keepers.
The start of where he played it, InVision, at the start.
And we particularly like the inner spin music.
That's the best music. Well, that could have come out of a number of different programmes, because I think it has a slightly otherworldly sound to it, which would not have been out of place in an episode of Doctor Who from around this time, which would have meant Colin Baker, I suppose, in 85. Wouldn't it have been? Yes.
Yes, it was. So I could imagine that music playing as Doctor Who is in a basement. Something is materialising, and as the form is filling in front of his eyes, he says, Cybermen!
It's your third letter, 37.
And that would be the end of the episode.
Yeah. So, inner spin, is that the most useful name for a letters round?
No. Well, this is the thing I was going to say. It's nothing to do with spinning. There's no spinning involved at all. I don't know why it's called inner spin. Well, we see three letters appear on the big screen, but they're not spinning. They're changing, but they're obviously changing according to some predetermined sequence.
What would you have
in order to arrive at those three letters? Clearly, the first inner spin round had been set up in advance in order for the letters to end up as ADM, wasn't it?
Yes.
To encourage them to come up with anti-establishmentarianism, which is such a pat answer for quizzes, I would guess.
So in May of 1985, Paul Coyer had launched Catchword on BBC Two, and Master Team had come along in October, so it's 5 months later. Do you feel that setting up and then debunking anti-disestablishmentarianism as an answer, is the Master Team production crew really sending a message to Paul Coyer's team about the veracity and weight of their quiz?
Fury's anti-disestablishmentarianism is not one word, it is two words, because it has a hyphen in the middle, so I'm afraid that neither of you score any...
You're listening to yourself as you're asking me that question.
What's your answer?
Well, it's such a ludicrous question.
What's your... You said you had some remarks about the rounds themselves anyway.
Well, I thought that the spotlight round is an odd one, because the teams are asked to pick who they obviously think is the weakest player from the other team.
Mm-hmm.
But they've only, certainly the first time they do it, they've only had about a minute to size up the opposition. So I'm not quite sure what value... I can see what they're trying to do with that and to introduce a bit of competition, but at that point in the proceedings, it's a very arbitrary way of setting it up, I think.
This sounds to me like the format of a Channel 4 discursive kind of panel show from the year 2000.
What, where they're trying to...
Well, there was one, wasn't there, where you, without prejudice, where you had to eliminate someone from a potential prize fund just from the way that they introduced themselves.
I don't remember that.
Lisa Tarbuck hosted.
Oh, now that does ring a bell, yes.
So do you think that maybe, actually, Master
it's
Team...
a precursor to that as well.
Possibly.
I thought that the... What was the very first round called before Spotlight? The one where they just answered questions?
Does it have a name? Let's go back and have a look. Hold on.
Master Two is the Master Team of 1985. And that's our cue to introduce the two teams who are going to play Master Team for the first time.
Again.
They come from Ormskirk and they represent the Midlands.
Okay, let's just skip through that. in general, on a quiz, do you like the contestants to be introduced, or do you like the contestants to introduce themselves?
As long as it's done quickly, I don't mind.
And I also have an issue where a contestant who is introducing themselves, which I think is fine, but when they do it with a cadence in terms of where they come from, where they then assume there will be some applause. So, for example, you know, one might say, "I'm Ian from London."
Oh, yeah, that's no good.
That's not right.
You're on a hiding to nothing with that sort of thing. You should just keep it.
So introduce yourself as it should be done.
"Hello, I'm Ian and I'm from London." That's all you need.
That's great. Okay,
so
that's
Midlands, and they are.
Kerry Satchel.
You see, he goes wrong because the very first thing he says is, And, I mean, of all the things that you're going to do and say on this programme, the one thing that you are most sure that you're going to have to say is your name. And yet, he can't even get that right.
Okay, let's just see what this first round is actually called.
Is it called first round?
It might be.
Well, now that you've met our two teams, the Furies and the Eagle and Child, let's go into our game. Round one. This is what we call a team challenge.
So it has a very generic name.
Oh, dear. Well, that's not... The very first round of the very first episode of this new quiz show hasn't even got a proper name.
So if you went to someone... They're trying to remember a quiz. What was it called now? I remember it definitely had Team Challenge.
Team Challenge.
It had
it
in a spin. Yeah. And it had Spotlight Round.
Spotlight Round. We've uncovered a problem here. Because there's so many names, some of which are memorable, some of which aren't, some of which have nothing to do with the quizzes, some of which are misleading. In a spin isn't even correct.
Spin. What would you like to say? I see In a Spin, I feel, should be around where they have to collect props.
What?
Just to run in a spin, because then they're, oh, is it over there? Or
that's now you're thinking of something like I don't know, that's not a 5:35, that's 5:10 children's.
But
program.
I want you to make In a Spin work for a tea time quiz slot. Then what happens in that round?
Well, they need to stay behind the desks.
Okay,
there could be no running about.
Okay,
what do you mean? For it to still have the name
In a Spin. I'm the producer, and I would say to you, we really like the name In a Spin. Okay. Angela Rippon is hosting.
Well, what you need then in the studio is some sort of prop which has three windows for the three letters. And Angela gets up. She's allowed to get up. She walks over and she kind of cranks a handle to set the three rotors in a spin.
Now,
so the letters go, they tick round. And then they're like a fruit machine, and then it comes up with ding, ding, ding.
Do you think that...
That would make sense. If you want to call it In a Spin, then at least there's some spinning going on.
But that's... When one hears the music that goes with it, that's actually probably what Graham Prescott thought it was going to be. Because it's a very carousel-y sort of a piece.
Yes. He's been misinformed. Somewhere along the... Maybe there was a change in the development of the programme.
Or perhaps the Catchword team had complained to the union that this would be a kind of a props issue. Who starts the In a Spin prop? Yes. Is it electricians?
Well, exactly. Angela could not be allowed due to union demarcation rules. She had to remain. This would be she'd be crossing over from being a presenter.
Yeah. To a props master,
to a props mistress, and therefore, well, that's like that's the way that in Blankety Blank, you never saw Terry had to say. To someone to reveal the legend. He couldn't reveal the legend himself because that would be that would cause all sorts of union problems.
Okay,
it
so
would
I
cause
think
a walkout.
We've got to the bottom of that. Was there more you wanted to say on the round?
I just wanted to mention the fact that very first round is such a damp squib.
Called?
Well, I've forgotten it already.
Team Challenge.
It's such a damp squib because in this episode that we watched, it lasted barely a minute.
Yes.
There are only about four or five questions asked. And For a first round of a first edition of a new quiz, you really want a big sort of whistles and bells thing. And yet this is over before it really started. I thought that was a bit of a bad decision.
Would that have worked better? We were talking about how I think we've come up with a definitive way people should be introduced on a quiz. But yes. Does that mean you would like to have known more about them?
I
personally wouldn't know.
I don't
give
a toss about any of them. And in fact, Angela already spends too long at the beginning talking about the reasons behind their team names. It reminds me of Tele Addicts, where you had the team names. And I don't think Noel laboured quite as long over explaining why Warriors Gate were called Warriors Gate. Well, did he? In fact, that actually is worth mentioning the fact that this year was also the first year of Telian.
Oh, was it? So, as Ian has pinpointed, actually, Telealex started this year, the month before
March. It was a bumper year for quizzes.
It really was.
On the BBC.
Yeah.
We've got three now, haven't we, so far? Master Team, Telealex, and Catchword.
One thing I feel that links, certainly Master Team and Telealex, is the use of picture-in-picture quantel. So I noticed that when we lose a team from Master Team, their picture is quantelled out. They slot in behind their Aster team.
They disappear behind the logo, don't they? But not the logo.
The Aster team.
Yes.
And then the next quizzing
team.
They emerge. No, they emerge
in the same place.
So they pass behind the Aster team and then come out via quantel.
Well, I mean, as soon as the BBC got quantel, they slapped it all over everything, didn't they? And quizzes were the obvious medium to showcase the full range of effects. Although I think Telealex takes the prize for the most amount of quantel in a quiz show. And I imagine Noel himself personally insisted on that because he wanted to... Well, as soon as he heard that there's some new technology was involved, we must have that, quick, let's slap it on everything.
I wonder if one could imagine coming in and saying, I was watching Channel 4.
Yes.
Letting that hang for a minute because people were like, why are you watching Channel 4?
What are you
doing?
And
I saw this show called The Tube and they wrapped... Stay with me. They wrapped the picture into the shape of a vase and then that vase shattered. Could we maybe do that?
And Noel was saying, no, this is the first... No, it's been on Channel 4, but no one watches it.
Well, he would say maybe the first time in an evening quiz. It's a mainstream evening quiz first.
First, yes.
We're going to quantel in
we're going to show
the Payne family.
We're going to show them as if they were actually on the TV screen. And then before your very eyes, that TV screen is going to shatter into 1,000 pieces. But don't worry, we're not actually shattering the panes. We're through the magic of television, I'm now going to appear with a tea, and he'd do that kind of, do a funny voice.
One thing that was very noticeable was that Terry Wogan was an answer and the audience tittered.
Oh, there's tittering, yes. Well, Wogan was the biggest man in Britain in 1985, wasn't he? Because that was the year his thrice weekly chat show had begun. So 85 is really emerging as a key year.
Mm.
But it's interesting that just the mere mention of Wogan...
The evocation of Terry.
...is enough to get the audience giggling.
It's a warm titter as well. It's not a derisory titter.
Oh, absolutely, because he's... Well, he's...
Like, yeah. Good old Terry.
Yes, and the fact that the floor dance was... At that point, it was at least, 6 or 7 years ago. Mm. It's still a national joke, even now. And even though the answer was just what was the name of the song, but that wasn't really that wasn't really the point that they mentioned that. They mentioned it just because they could. Most TV programs around that time would have a mention of Terry Wogan at some point.
Terry was on that day.
Which day of the week was this then? It must have been
it was a Monday.
Monday, yeah, of course, yeah.
So I have the Radio Times billing. Now, of course, it doesn't have any guest details.
No, it's just one line. And the billing is this: is Terry, the 20th century Sisyphus, struggling away on Shepherd's Bush Green?
So, Ian, I have a couple of other things.
Okay.
I think this is going to scratch an itch. I got this together
specifically. Oh, well, this might be about to answer my one remaining question about this.
Okay. Program. So, you're ready to hear this?
Yep.
Dave, three subjects are left for you: current affairs, potpourri, or history.
Well, I've paused the clip. And we heard the man start to make a purr sound, so he's clearly going to pick potpourri. What do you hope will happen?
I'm hoping that Angela delivers what, if memory serves, is one of her enduring lines from this programme, where she then explains to viewers, in rather pitiless detail, what exactly potpourri means.
Okay, shall we have a listen?
Yes.
Potpourri.
Potpourri, which is, of course, sort of mixture of all the other subjects put together, which means you have 1 minute.
When I watch that now, I wonder whether she was lumbered with this name that she was livid about, and it doesn't work, and so that she underlined it each time by going to that fussy explanation.
She tries to undermine it by saying it wrong,
mm.
and then adding. Well, I'm possibly, but now I'm also wondering now whether at this point in time in the mid 80s, whether many people actually were aware of what potpourri was.
This was potpourri's heyday, wasn't it?
Well, made, well, it was it not one of those things that had only ever been featured in sort of domestic dramas and
sitcoms.
But not really as something that was serious. It denoted something, didn't it? It denoted someone a bit above their station. But if a housewife had a bowl of potpourri in their house, they were aspiring towards sort of a social status they didn't have.
But potpourri was introduced because, and I do think this was its heyday, because in the sitcom there would be the storyline where someone holds a posh dinner and then one of the guests doesn't know if that's a nibble or not.
Oh, and they go to eat some of it.
Yes.
And then there's an awkward misunderstanding.
So I would think this is very much the heyday of potpourri.
Well, that would have been a Terry and June sort of scenario, wouldn't it, when Thingamy came round for dinner.
But it does feel that she's railing against
that. Has it passed
that.
Over into common parlance? That's my question. I'm not sure whether it has.
Well, then maybe it was Angela that did that.
She actually was responsible for popularising potpourri.
So people think, I'm looking for a mixed bag, a little bit of something else.
Yeah,
it's a variance
not quite
of
sure
items.
What we're going to get.
Potpourri seems to fit the bill. Okay, now this is...
We're jumping forward a couple of years.
We are jumping forward. One of the things... in fact, let's look at the clip, and then there's something specific that comes to mind. But what we're going to look at is this was a pre-title sequence scene from the 1987 series. So what we're looking at here is Angie's come away from her desk, isn't she? And she's in the studio, and she's about to sort of set the scene for this run.
Hello. Well, in a minute, we're just about to start a brand new series of Master Team, which means that we're going to be here 5 nights a week for the next 9 weeks. Now, in that time, I'm going to be asking something in excess of 5,000 questions, and I'm going to be putting 65 teams in the spotlight and probably in a spin as well. Now, in 1985, our winners came from the Northwest, and they were the Warrington Sports Club. Who will ever forget Olive and her knowledge of pop music? 1986 saw our first overseas winners. They were the Antrim Coasters, three smiling lads from Northern Ireland who didn't know where the Giant's Causeway was. So who will be the winners this year? Well, we found teams from all corners of Britain to challenge for the title of Master Team 87.
So the thing that strikes me about that, which I feel is another 80s thing, is the thing of tagging the year to the show. Do you agree that that was... So that she actually did refer to the first one as Master
yes.
Team 85.
Well, yeah, and another obvious example springs to mind is the Holiday programme, that throughout that decade, it just stopped being called Holiday, and it became Holiday 82, Holiday 86, or whatever. I think the clothes show ended up doing that as well, possibly.
Do you miss it?
Yes.
Do you think that we're probably
in a century where it just isn't going to work? I think I can understand why...
Pointless 16.
It's not done so much because we're not far enough through the century for the years to have a bit of weight to them, a bit of heft.
Because the last flourishing of it, I suppose, would have been 2000, Castaway 2000, where...
Well, yeah, but that was because the year 2000 itself was such a big deal that you could stick it on the end of any programme in an attempt to try and make it a bit more special.
When would it be acceptable to bring the years back? Do we have to get into the 2050s?
I think you need to get to a point where you've got more... there are enough syllables in the number that for it to have a bit of a rhythm to it.
So the Chase 55?
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Fine.
It's still yours.
Any last words on Master Team before we move on to your choice?
Yeah, well, it was lovely to see it again because I haven't seen many clips, in fact, any clips for a long time.
Would you want to see any more of this?
I'm not sure I would, sadly. It was nice to see it, but I wouldn't want to watch a whole week's worth. Okay, we've just watched, enjoyed and discussed Graham's choice. It's now my time to reveal mine. Right, so I'm going to press play now and we're going to see what Graham's response is as the programme begins.
Okay, this is good. It's hearty. There's Paul. I'm just going to laugh because this title sequence is so replete with excitement. I've seen that clip of George Cole and Dennis Waterman doing What Are We Going to Get for Christmas for Our Indoors on Hearty. So this is a good start.
Well, we've paused it now. We've just seen the opening titles.
He's arriving as One Must Down Some Stairs.
To an edition of Hearty, As Graham was saying as the titles rolled, we saw a collection of
clips. There was Paul McCartney. Russell. Should we call him Hearty or Russell? Russell.
Russell. Russell.
He was being made to put on and he was making a bit of a thing of it. A breakfast time sweater. Yes. Kind of,
Frank and Selena were there with him. We also saw David Bellamy with an amusingly shaped object.
Yes, it looked a bit like a bottom.
We saw...
we might have to go
to George Cole and Dennis Waterman.
Definitely doing what will I get for Christmas for
We also saw Russell singing with the Flying Pickets.
Yes.
We saw a small child showing her knickers. We also saw him walking on with two large beasts at the very beginning.
Oh, from where the wild things are.
Yes. Anyway, it was just a montage really of clips. Okay. And this is an edition of Hearty. How much should I tell you now about when it is?
Well, let's see if I can pick it up.
And see what happens.
Okay, so we'll go on a recording break.
Good evening. Last night, we rather foolhardily asked any ladies who would like to propose to their chaps live on this programme tonight to ring us. You will not be surprised to hear, as a result, rather a lot of people called. So in our audience are some very wary gentlemen who don't yet know that some extraordinary proposals will be coming their way before this night is out.
Well, what we just watched was an edition of Hearty from 1984. To be precise, it was transmitted on the 29th of February 1984, hence the leap year theme. And just to put this into some context, this was Russell's final... stint. This is his final iteration as a chat show host, the BBC One show. We did this for a couple of years and it would be live twice a week, I think Tuesdays and Wednesdays. This was on Wednesday the 29th of February, which is why at the end we hear him say next Tuesday, and we get that rather helpful caption to remind us to tune in again next Tuesday. We've done all that. Now tell me, what are your initial impressions of what you've just seen?
I love the title sequence, which really kind of mashes together everything that was good about Hearty. He was very much about happenings, but small staged events. But I think the thing that struck me watching that 40 minutes, it's a very saggy 40 minutes. And I have always felt about Hearty, as much as I enjoy him and find his slightly weird turn of phrase quite interesting, he never... ever establishes a rapport with anyone and never seems to have any real affinity with anyone he's talking to.
Well, I think that's true, I would say, for most of the people in this particular edition, but I think there's a rapport he has with Kenneth Williams, because they've met several times before.
Kenny sits down, starts doing his thing.
But that's his shtick, though, isn't it?
But then Russell breaks into asking a question, and then he says, why are you pulling your socks up to Kenny?
Why are you pulling your socks up?
Oh, yes, well, we were together in Manchester, remember?
And he does this all the way through. He has these very sort of pointed sort of... accusing people in his questioning style. He suddenly comes up with something very blunt. And we have who is the composer,
Alan J. Lerner, and he says to his new wife, Alan's new wife,
well, there is a little discrepancy in your height.
That's right.
In your height. Yes.
So there's a woman who comes on, the first one, and she's wearing this kind of very strange floral outfit. But clearly it's a big day for her. She's going to propose. And Hearty comes on and says, what are you wearing?
Right, now, why are you dressed like this in a curtain?
One of the best, isn't it?
Right.
I don't like his brusqueness. Thing.
That was part of his shtick, though, wasn't it? The fact that he was a bit of an oddball. He was an unlikely host.
So you're going to say unlikable?
Well, I don't think you could ever accuse Hearty of being that.
Okay.
Well, I don't think so, anyway. He just had this... He was never really... Well, certainly in this show, he's never quite at ease with the surroundings and what's going on around him.
He's just not connected to anything that's going on.
But he just keeps everything ticking over. I mean, the show finishes on time. Nothing rambles.
No, okay.
Which is just as well, given some of the segments. Okay, well, let's go back and look at some of the individual bits.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the set.
The set... I like the set very much. It's certainly of the...
Have you ever seen any set like that before?
Well, I think I have. I think it's a kind of a generic chat show set. So it's very beige. There's that kind of stippling paint effect on the walls. There is this kind of motif, which all the sets, you know, Terry would have a motif of sort of pyramids, or he would have
objects.
A sphere, yes. And whereas in Russell's there are these kind of almost like the Chinese lanterns, but it's sort of these diamond shaped things in the background. And then there's these kind of corners where there's foliage. That's very Terry Wogan as well,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, well, it sort of humanises it a bit as well, doesn't it? It takes the edge off the design. I think that's probably an American thing. From the American talk shows, where there's always lots of plants on display.
There's
but what about that? You haven't mentioned that the big...
The staircase?
No. The banquette.
Oh, yes. So
Have you ever seen that before in any kind of programme ever?
There is a vast banquette
where it curves around the...
So he and his guests are perched just on one end of it. And it's as if they must, when they designed it, they must have been thinking that some episodes are going to have the roly-polies on or something, whereby the whole banquette would be filled up.
Well, we saw that clip at the beginning of him with the flying picket, so you can imagine them all in a row.
So how many could you seat on that banquette, do you think? It must be about a 12 or something.
I'd say a dozen.
So when that banquette isn't full, they look quite lonely. And as you say, Alan, what's his face? Doesn't really know where he should sit.
No, he comes on and he sits down quite a distance from Russell. And then he's, I better move up a bit. But even then, there's still a noticeable gap that is slightly too far apart.
Well, they haven't got the chat vocabulary right, which is you need to have the host. He needs to be separated. So he has his own seat or sofa, and then the guest comes in and they then pop themselves down facing him. Whereas they're sort of by each other, and it looks a bit like they're on public transport because of that.
Well, I guess this was probably the thinking that they wanted this to be a more slightly looser, more freewheeling format. I mean, he says at one point he thinks of the show as a bit like a cocktail hour with people dropping in.
But the
banquette, I noticed no one went on. None of the crew nipped on to plump up the cushions.
No, I noticed
between that.
That.
So when Alan came on, it was all ruffled from when Kenny had been there.
We should talk also about when he is... he's saying who his guests are going to be. When he gets Tina Turner, he does this kind of double fist clench.
I think he always overpromises because he says he thinks that Tina Turner's going to raise the room.
Yeah.
But as we later turn out, she kind of lowers the temperature rather than raising the roof because her performance is not what you expect. Anyway, we can come on to that later.
Did you notice then with Kenny that actually as soon as he starts answering, he hasn't said anything funny, but the audience start laughing.
Thank you. May I say what a great honour it is. I say what a great honour it is for you to have me.
All he has to do is to appear and to sit down in a very kind of flamboyant way. and the audience are already tittering. But certainly of the segments, I think the Kenny bit is the most successful, would you say?
Yes, I would, yeah.
Then we have the first of the people segments. Now, this is something I don't think you see anymore on television. Members of the public who are involved in the fabric of the programme, not merely just telling a story or being there for the purpose of an anecdote, but they have to then do something else.
Mm.
Be it, in this case, they're dressing up.
Jeanette. What have you come as, Jeanette?
A hod carrier.
Or they're doing a rhyme or they're singing a song.
And this is the women who've come on to propose, isn't it? But it's all
been scripted. It's all heavily prepped.
And there's another woman who comes on in her kind of stockings and suspenders. And that was still acceptable in the 80s for women to wear.
Well,
that
kind of a naughty sort of slightly titillating thing, but played for laughs.
Yeah.
And I think, it's interesting in each of the cases that of all these women, they throw themselves into it, but the men sitting in the audience, and for them it's no surprise that this is going on, but all of them, I think, without exception, are pretty nonplussed.
Yeah.
What did you say?
Okay.
Yeah. And as you pointed out when we were watching it, that these women come on, they propose marriage to the men. The men say something very monosyllabic like, okay, yes. Okay,
yeah.
Then the woman is allowed to go back into the audience. But before we see her greeting her now fiancé, it cuts back to Russell. Yes.
We don't see any of the couples together ever again. Even at the end when they all come onto the stage, they are apart in a kind of a big sort of throng. And it's like, we must get... Russell is the star. We must always cut back to Russell.
It's so abstract what's happened between them. It's a very untelevisual idea.
Now, what about the musical segments? First of all, we have a singer called Liz Robertson, who is the fairly recently married wife of Alan J. Lerner.
And as Russell belabours, taller than him.
Yes, he makes that point several times. And she is brought on to sing a specially composed song. Well, we can talk about the song itself in a minute. But first of all, accompanying her at the piano is none other than...
Gerard Kenny.
Good old New York, New York. So good they named it twice.
Appearing in his only non-New York, New York appearance on British television.
As is established beforehand, he had actually appeared on the show the previous week.
Presumably doing New York, New York.
New York, New York, oh, the scandal and the vice.
You'd hope. And yet here he is, just reduced to the role of an accompanist. Although he did co-compose the song with Alan J.
And they're going on to work on something together.
They would, and indeed they did go on to write a musical together, which was a flop. But here we have Kenny. He doesn't say anything. He's just sitting there at the piano. And he doesn't even join the others afterwards.
No.
But the song itself, I think I said this to you as you were watching it, it's what you would do if you were asked to compose a pastiche of a bad musical song. That's exactly what it sounds like.
Now when an invitation comes my way, this is what I say.
And then she goes over and joins him for an incredibly awkward piece of conversation with Russell. And throughout, they do not seem, Alan and Liz, they do not seem to be at all comfortable in each other's presence, let alone Hartie's presence.
But that's because he keeps him, and Hartie brings up the fact that
that's Hartie's fault?
Yes, because he brings up the fact that she famously said that she was never going to marry a foreigner. A small man. What was
and a smoker.
And a smoker. And then he points out that Alan is all three. The end of the item. So Russell thanks them. And then she is more aware of the fact that they need to stay seated until the camera cuts to Russell again. Whereas Alan tries to get up and she actually forces him.
She grabs hold of his arm and actually forces him back down onto the onto the banquette. It's an incredibly painful bit of television to see. And I'll tell you about what happened to those two.
Oh, please,
later.
Please.
Tina Turner is the other big. Now, actually, that segment goes some way to retrieving some of the energy of the programme at the beginning. She's a very good guest, I think.
Well, I think she's
surprisingly good, maybe.
I think she's very much game for a laugh, but actually her answers are quite short, aren't they, initially?
When you were a little girl in Nutbush, it's very hard for me to say Nutbush, because I want to say Nutbush or Nutbush, 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 Nutbush,
yes.
In Tennessee, did you warble in front of a mirror?
All the time.
What did you wear in those days? Or nearly wear?
My mother's things.
Yeah. And you braided your hair?
No, I took it down.
Down, not off?
No, not off.
She goes with the flow and rolls along with his impudence.
I think that's because, I think, actually watching it, I think she is a little bit out of breath from the performance. It takes a little while to get going because she's still in her kind of performer mode.
Well, we should say what, because she had been performing her version of the Beatles' Help, which is...
well, let's hear a little bit of it.
Okay.
So help me if you can, I'm feeling down. And I do appreciate you being around.
Because she has reversioned this song so much that she may as well have written a new one. And it puts me in mind of when Al Gerard came onto Wogan, which I think Brucey was hosting at the time, and he did a version of the Moonlighting theme. And he scats around with it and so much that I always remember that when he finished, Bruce, he makes some remark.
I mean, you go all round the tune, you know. Is it because you don't like the original tune?
And she's done that with Help.
She's completely changed the tune. So for a start, it's in a major key rather than a minor key. She slowed it right down. She's put in all these flourishes for these vocal embellishments and also that saxophone solo in the middle.
It's a fine sax break because the man plays the sax in the way it should be done, which is as if the sax is fighting him. So it's like he's Johnny Weissmuller wrestling a snake or something.
But it's a very arid performance. And Tina, it's almost as if Tina knows this. She tries to overcompensate by doing too many ornamentations and flourishes and everything, and it just kind of ends, fades away to nothing, and then she trots over to Russell and she's all out of breath, as if she's actually been exerting it, but you haven't really seen evidence that she's been exerting herself.
So you think that explains why?
I think that's why initially she just kind of restricts herself to one answers, but she does get better, and there's a nice bit of business where they get up and she teaches Russell a bit of dancing.
And actually, he seems to want that to go on for longer because she sits down. And yes. What's he doing?
Well, he turns back to her, so we see...
Is he doing a hoochie-coochie move?
And he starts kind of doing a bit of grinding towards her, which... Which I guess he is playing off the fact that he is the most, he is clearly an unlikely person to be doing this kind of movement.
Yeah.
And Tina finds it hilarious.
Yes.
And this kind of sets the tone for the rest of the thing, where there's a little bit of talk about the problems that she's had, but it's much more lighthearted, and it ends with him, obviously a kind of a pre-arranged bit where she proposes to him, and they go into this big embrace.
And then he does that thing where he kind of, as they're embracing, his hand comes up and waves the camera crew away, as if he's sort of saying, oh no, finish the show because we're going to smooch.
Yes, but thankfully that doesn't happen.
That's a good bit. I like that bit.
But that kind of, that energy and that sort of, that tone is then all dissipated because the final bit are these women, are the three women in the fancy dress.
So let's set the scene. So one woman is dressed, so three women now come on together and it's going to be a quickfire proposal session.
Already you sense that time is running short because Russell's questions become even more brief and terse.
So there's a woman who's dressed as a hod carrier. And at one point he says to her,
do you think you're a little bit podgy when you're dressed in ordinary clothes?
Which doesn't seem a very helpful question. What's the second? So the second woman is
dressed as a maid.
As a maid with a pint. And actually Russell does quite a fun thing where he takes a sip of the pint while she's posing.
Yes.
And then the last one is the naughty.
As kind of in a sort of half lingerie outfit.
Sort of a basque.
She says she's come as next to nothing, doesn't she?
That's right. That's her description.
But then, as the singer tune rolls at the end, I think there's a very nice bit where every single person who's been involved in the show, that's the members of the public and the likes of Tina Turner.
And the backing groups.
And the backing groups from the respective groups. Mm. They all come onto the stage together and just mingle.
And you see Kenny giving congratulations to
the new couples. Kenny goes around to the new couples, giving what looks like sincere congratulations to them. And it all ends on quite a nice little note of camaraderie, I think.
What do you think would have been the chat coming off the floor? Were people, do you think the production team and Russell would be all pumped up saying, wow, we really nailed that show? Or do you think they would just be kind of like, right, okay, see you tomorrow or see you next week?
I think there'll be an element to that because whenever you've got these sorts of shows which are on all the time, you're only ever thinking ahead. I think you're only ever as good as the next one. And so they would have thought, okay, another one done. Let's think about next week. And
but I suppose my feeling was it.
Do you think there's a workmanlike attitude to it?
Yes. It's a slightly desultory sort of. It's just stuff that's happened and then they stop.
I think that works if you put it in the context of when it went out, a sort of midweek slot, not really prime time, but bridging the gap between 60 minutes. Mm. This failure of a magazine show and the main evening's.
So do you think they're thinking that people are maybe making their dinner and possibly even eating their dinner?
It's TV to watch while you're eating or while you're doing the washing up.
I suppose I'm being a little hard because there is an element of the nowness of it and the topicality because it is very specific to that day in that it is leap year. It's the 29th of February. And was that always a case with Hearty that there would be something that is reflective of...
Well, yes, and that was where it differed so much from Wogan, where Wogan's guests were booked well in advance and he never really did any topical stuff, certainly not in the early years.
Well, that's what Michael Grade said, wasn't it? You go to the Wogan office and you would see the lineup of guests for the next 6 months.
Yes.
I'd like to thank all my guests tonight and thank God it'll be another 4 years before there's another February 29th. May all the propositions made tonight end in very happy marriages.
And before the decade was out, most of the people who appeared on that programme were dead.
Okay.
Alan J. Lerner was dead within 2 years. He did, as he suggested in the programme, write a musical with Gerard Kenny, but as I say, it was a flop. And then he was actually asked by Andrew Lloyd Webber to start to work on Phantom of the Opera.
Okay.
But he died. So this might well have been his last appearance on British television. Kenneth Williams was on to promote a book called Backdrops, which was the name of the collection of diary entries which he wrote, which were actually from, as Russell says, from 1981. So it was a few years before. This was 84, so it wasn't very recent. And in fact, he actually had elaborated a lot of the entries and cherry-picked stuff from earlier in his career to spice up some of the entries.
Was this the first time his diaries had been published?
This was the first time anything from his own diaries had been put into the public domain, and probably the first time that he had really made it common knowledge that he kept diaries. And obviously once he died, the diaries would be published more or less in full. But around, he was doing, this was one of a number of engagements he did around this time to promote the book. He had also, this week he also appeared on TVAM, joining Rusty Lee for some cookery.
Yeah, I don't mind breaking an egg or two, but I haven't got to actually toss it, because I'm no good at tossing at all.
I'm sure it'll be marvellous.
But he also appeared on Highway with Harry Secombe. And Looks Familiar.
Wow, with Dennis Norden.
Yes. Tina Turner. This version of Help, was only the second time she went on to make the top 40 charts in the UK as a solo artist. But this song only went to number 40.
Okay.
So it was a flop. Okay. However, next year, the following year, she would have a big hit with What's Love Got to Do with It. And as for Russell Harty himself, this show would run for the rest of the year. There'd be a brief break during the summer, but only for the show to be renamed Summer Harty.
Well, we've come to Brighton Beauty, for the last programme in this summer series. And what with one thing and another, and I do mean another, it looks as though it's going to be quite an away day beside the sea.
Which is actually on location in both in the UK and in the US. Because another thing he did this year was he was the BBC special correspondent reporting from the Olympics.
Was he?
Yes.
Why Harty?
Well, because he's Russell Harty.
Okay.
But there, I was checking, and there was a spin-off as well called Harty in Hollywood.
Hello and good evening to you in Britain, and good morning from us all here in the hot Los Angeles. The razzmatazz of the last weekend is over. The flame is burning brightly just over there in the Coliseum, and the pigeons are all flying away to their separate homes, and balloons have all gone up in the air.
But they're also around this year.
So Summer Harty, Harty in Hollywood. Hollywood.
As well as Harty.
Okay.
So it was a Harty year for Russell.
For Russell, wow.
And then this show came back in September, and it ran to the end of the year, whereupon it was axed to make way for Wogan.
Oh, you stopped. The all-new BBC. And then they have to rely on somebody like me to start it. Anyway, welcome to the beginning of what I hope will be a long and happy relationship. At 7 o'clock every Monday, Wednesday and Friday, this show will be coming to you live from the BBC Television Theatre on verdant Shepherd's Bush Green, London.
I wonder if there is a reason why, for us, for people of our age, at that particular era of television, is one that we have a particular affinity with.
Well, actually, see, Master Team now, that's a cocktail hour quiz show.
I wouldn't say it's tea time. Tea time is different than cocktail hour.
I'm not talking about the specific hour, I'm talking about the tone.
Oh, no.
Do you think Master Team's a little more
I would say Eggheads is a cocktail hour.
Is it?
Program. Yes.
Is Pointless a cocktail
hour?
No.
That's tea time.
But I'm not talking about a slot. I'm talking about a tone, about an approach.
I think there's a difference of tone.
Okay.
Master Team does not have the same tone as something that would have been on it before, after tea, after the news. It's 6 o'clock news. That's the key.
And then you can have the cocktail.
Yes. Okay. You can only have the cocktail after you've had the news.
Okay.
You can't have it before six. Heavens above.
Could you say which you enjoyed watching most, do you think? Or did you not enjoy
Harty?
Harty, you think?
Yeah. Because I think Master Team, although I started off enjoying it, I became bored because it started repeating itself. Whereas at least with Harty, even the bits that weren't working, they were over fairly quickly. And then another bit came along.
That's true.
And you could then see, what's going to happen now?
Harty was a bit of an endurance, but I suppose there were bits.
Well, a half-hour Harty, I think, would have been the ideal. Harty. A Harty half-hour Harty.
Yeah. Cocktail half-hour.
Yes, would have been the ideal format for that.
You've been listening to What We Just Watched from TV Cream, in which we watched the first episode of Master Team from the 21st of October 1985
and an edition of Harty from February 29th, 1984.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Here's a bit from next Monday's What We Just Watched.
Please! Please, June, what have you done to yourself?
Well, just following your instructions, I've been defrumping myself.
But June, your hair, your beautiful hair.
Oh, no, Terry, it was old-fashioned and frumpy.